We're back where, when you were doing photography, articles in New York and for various magazines, was this also, did this overlap your teaching poetry courses part-time?
It was all during the same 7 or 8 year period, and the connection that I had, the experience that I had as a kid in photography was all in commercial photography. But in that studio, I found some books that contained what I guess you'd call art photography, and got very attached to certain of those pictures, and they gave me great solace.
Do you remember whose photographs they are?
Yeah, I fell in love with A. Aubrey Bodine, who was the a pictorial photographer working for for a newspaper in Baltimore, and who photographed a lot in the Chesapeake Bay and did seascapes and misty, like posed misty mid-regions of Weir in photography. And those pictures mesmerized me and gave me great solace and spoke to those parts of my mind and heart that nobody else or no other thing was speaking to. And they were like prayers for me. I stayed with them and meditated on them through hard times in my life. So I had a very profound connection with visual images. Even at the time that there was nobody to talk to or nobody to share any of those experiences with. So when I got through the experience of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock some connection with other people interested in such things, I was led immediately into a lifelong connection with painting, and into a lifelong love of certain painters, which has sustained me through hard times.
What painters would those be?
Well, at the first painters that had a real claim on me were the abstract expressionists in the mid-50s. Pollock and Klein and Motherwell, and that led, and Gauguin and Monet and Brancusi, the sculptor Brancusi, all of the impressionists and post-impressionists, Van Gogh, I spent a lot of time in the art library looking at books and following my interests there. I became interested, as I did in literary history, in art history, and took a lot of courses when I was in college. And always the first thing I would do when I had a chance would be to go see these paintings when I was in New York or wherever. I went, one of the first fearless thing I ever did in my life was between my junior and senior year, no, between my sophomore and junior year of college, I packed up my bags and took my savings from my paper route and told Granny I was gone and went to Paris without a word of French.
How old were you?
I was 19 years old, and or 20 years old. It was 55, summer of 55.
You were in college in Lexington
I
at the
was in
time.
college in Lexington. I was 20 years old. I had not a word of French. I didn't know anybody in Paris. And on the lead of Hemingway, whom I had gotten to through Eliot, and already by that time extensive interest in Paris and all that had happened in Paris in the teens and in the 20s, went to Hemingway's part of town, to Montparnasse, found me a little hotel off the boulevard, and holed up and acted like a writer. But the first thing I did when I got to Paris was I went to the cafes, and the second thing I went to the Louvre, and I went started going to the galleries and to all the museums in town. I spent as much time in the Louvre and in the museums as I did on the streets. But that, I mean, when I got to New York on the way to Paris, the first thing I did was go to the Museum of Modern Art, and the second thing, the Metropolitan, and then to whatever galleries I could find.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, did you feel that the various media that you were interested in were feeding off one another,
yes,
in terms
of your
writing and your painting and your photography?
Oh, very much so. They were connected to the same part of my mind and soul. And I didn't have any words for this, but in that list of painters a while ago, the most obvious omission was Matisse. When I got to New York, I went straight to the museum and I went around to through all the rooms, and I found what attracted me, and I sat down in front of it, and I spent a lot of time in the Matisse room. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time in the Brancusi room. And Picasso was a monumental figure to me at that time, although none of his canvases made the connection that I was making with at that time with Matisse and with Bonnard and Gauguin and Van Gogh. And later on, the connection with Monet got real deep, and then later on still the connection with Rothko, which is one of the primary sources of spiritual stability in my life, Rothko. And I understood at the time that the experience that I was having with literature and with painting were all of a piece. And the connection I had with photography came in that context. And I never was disconnected from the commercial end of photography, but my inclinations were always towards Edward Weston and Stieglitz and Adams and mm-hmm. Atje and Cartier-Bresson and the photographers who end up in the museums.
Many of the, especially the painters and the writers you've referred to, were able to make those same connections among one another in circles of their day. Were you ever able to find a circle of friends or colleagues that shared your interests in that way?
I have lifelong connections in the literary world with both poets and fiction writers. I have lifelong connections in the photography world, and only a few painters. And I don't know. I know and have been friends with many of the gifted photographers and writers of my generation. None of the painters. I mean, I've known a couple, mm-hmm. and I've been in their studios, but I have never had the kind of work-a-day relationship with those people that I've had with poets.
I guess what I'm also asking is that sort of connection important to you, or do you feel that working alone is more important? Not working alone, but...
I thrive.
Not getting those connections in order to work.
I don't know about need, but I thrive on the connection that I have with my peers, with my writing colleagues, and with my photography colleagues. And nothing, I would rather go into the studio of some of the people that I know and spend the day than just about anything. And in extended conversations over a period of years and years with these people have been very fruitful to me.
Mm-hmm.
Writers that I'm close to now, a connection is basically that of friends. We share a lot and talk about a lot of experience that we have as writers, but basically those friendships now are just like friendships. They're not mm-hmm. professional. Some of them
right.
are strictly writer to writer, but most of them are just like friends.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what happened from that period that you were teaching poetry part-time? Well, also, can you talk about that class? What happened when you took over Denise's letter?
Oh, they were, rightly shocked and surprised and incredulous when Denise Levertov didn't walk in, when somebody they'd never heard of walked in before. And I mean, let me say again that was in 1968, when at the height of the counterculture revolution, and MIT and Harvard Square were the focuses for it in all New England. And
right.
You know, it was a very politicized situation in which everybody's authority was under constant challenge. And so walking into as a non-poet into this workshop was a very demanding and very thrilling situation. I mean, I was really on the line. I had to earn my authority as such as I could,
right.
in right in front of them, right in front of myself.
And a lot of the best names in poetry or best known names were in that area at the time.
Oh yeah, they looked forward to taking his class with one of the best known poets in the language at the time. But classrooms have always been hospitable places for me. I've always felt comfortable going through the door, either as a teacher or as a student. And once you get in there and start talking and dealing, it can be very exhilarating to me. And the minute it gets exhilarating, then everything else that needs to follows.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out fine. MIT is a quite special place to teach. Those kids are really, really bright. And the idea that they're all science whizzes does not preclude the possibility that they're intensely interested in a lot of other things. And many of them come there as science whizzes and end up wanting to be writers or painters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the photography department at MIT was at the time one of the, it was a forerunner of creative photography being brought into the academy. And so they had a lot of hot shots in the photography department over there, and was cross-registered with Harvard. And it was exhilarating to teach at that level.
And what sort of involvement did you have with the photography department?
Well, I taught a beginning photography class now and again, and I taught a class in words and pictures once. And I had the head of the department was Minor White, who was the publisher of Aperture. Mm-hmm. I was a contributing editor for Aperture, so I had a kind of conversation going with him. And was practicing. Most of my creative energies at the time were in photography. I was out shooting a lot, and I was exhibiting and publishing and pursuing my, if you want to call it, professional career as an artist in that realm during those years. And it was when I got in 1973 back to Lexington, which was the beginning of my long drawn out confrontation with my sources and with my home and with my family and with my origins. It was at that point that I withdrew from the photography world and said, okay, any more photography that I do henceforth, I'm going to do around the edges. I'm devoting my creative energies henceforth to poetry writing and to fiction writing.
What caused you to move back to Lexington?
Well, I got the marriage was coming unhinged, and I was no longer comfortable with being supported by my wife. I wanted a full-time job, and the options that I had were to try to get one in Cambridge or in New York or Lexington. My old and dear friend Wendell Berry was teaching at UK at the time, and as it turned out, all I had to do was to ask for a job at UK. A lot of my former professors were still there. I was known. I could have a job at UK if I wanted it. And if I had gone to New York or to Cambridge, I would have still been living at home, and I needed at that point to try. The plan was at that time to try to save our marriage, and I came to Lexington in order to live half the year round, you know, apart from the marriage that I'd had for 13 years, and to see if it couldn't be worked out along those lines. But it turned out, history has shown me, that it was a much more complex move than that, and it was a precursor to a divorce, to the dissolution of that marriage, and that was the first step in coming back to face where I'd come from and the trauma of my childhood.
I see. So when you came with an appointment to UK.
Yeah. Right? I came as a visiting writing teacher for a year, and the idea was that if I wanted to stay on and they wanted me to stay on, that it could turn into a full-time or a continuing job, which it did. I wanted to stay, and they were agreeable, so I just hooked right in.
And what were you teaching?
Portrait writing and fiction writing. And I didn't teach anything else until... I didn't teach anything else for 10 years.
Was this both at the graduate and undergraduate
yeah.
levels?
Yeah, we had it. When I went in 73, I think Wendell and I were the only full-time writing teachers. No, there were three of us. But the third one was part-time or was a yearly appointment. And we didn't always have three, and there were only like six classes offered. And then after Wendell left and Gurney Norman came, and Gurney and I are still the full-time and regular faculty members at UK, things sort of stabilized, and we got three full-time writing teachers, and it doesn't allow for much slack in the rope. Sometimes I'm able to teach other things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sick and tired of teaching poetry writing workshops and fiction writing workshops, and occasionally I get to do other things.
Such as what?
I taught a graduate course in approaches to poetry a couple of years ago, and I'm going to teach a course the first chance I get in experimental film and poetry and dream. I've also become involved over the past 8 years in filmmaking and have made some experimental films, and I'm interested in things and have conjunctions in my experience that want me to make up courses that aren't there to be taught, but I've got a course that I'm going. I will someday teach if I ever get the help that I need. A course in American experimental film since the end of the war. But before that, I'm going to teach a studio course in experimental film, poetry, and dream. And
dream, are you talking about Jungian sort of approaches to art, or what?
Yeah, Jung would be part of on the reading list, and Freud, and James Hillman, and other people who have thought about what dreams are and where they come from. And that would be the sleeping part of our lives and the recollections that we have from it, which in most instances are recollections of dreams, are our ongoing and common engagement with that part of the mind that art comes from, and the connection with that part of the mind is essential to make an art, any kind of art. And the idea of putting experimental film, which operates at such a variance from what most people expect when they think about film, is exclusively within the realm of intuition and instinct, and you can't make any sense out of it if you bring a rational kind of linear mind to it. And dreams likewise, and a lot of poetry likewise, and it's of course constructed to isolate people in a certain realm where linear abecedarian thought doesn't apply, all right? By way of thinking and talking about the way parts of the mind work and that part of the mind that artists live off of.
Right. And so are you scheduled to teach?
Well,
is this still in the planning process?
No, I said I wanted to do this, and the people in charge of such things are very receptive to it. But what I need in order to do it is enough faculty to teach the writing courses that we have got to offer,
right,
and some secretarial help. Like, in order to teach experimental film, a survey course in American experimental film, I need somebody to get the films to the campus and to make sure the screenings, I mean, that's a whole lot of secretarial work. I need some help in doing that, right?
Okay.
And I need that kind of help. I need a budget in order to rent the films, and I need some help in getting them screened on a regular basis. And those things have to be worked out.
Well, since you've been at UK, have there been changes that you've introduced in the teaching of creative writing there? I know that everybody has their own way of teaching it, but have there been things that you specifically have introduced?
Not one important change. We were teaching what we called creative writing when I came, which included both poetry and fiction, and I got that split up into poetry and fiction writing workshops immediately. And I went through a period in which we tried to create and implement a graduate program in creative writing. We, for a couple of years in there, offered an MA in creative writing. But we didn't have the faculty to do it. It was stretched to the breaking point right from the inception of the idea. We had a very interesting looking faculty on paper, all right? Wendell was teaching again, Guy Davenport was there, they were related professors, and Gurney and myself and Percival Everett were the full-time writing teachers. And not all of those people are on the graduate faculty, and not all of them were in continuous residency, and too much of the work fell to me. There wasn't any money or energy in the idea of offering creative writing MA to sustain it, except at great cost to me. So if you want to say one of the things I did was to implement this idea and then dismantle it, all right?
One step forward.
Yeah, right. It was one hesitant step forward and then three or four back. Quickly, but we did give three or four MAs for a while, and I had a lot to do with instigating that whole plan. It was not a good idea.
So you don't think that will be implemented again in the future?
That will not be tried again. Not while we look like we look now. Not while I'm there. You can get an MA in creative writing in Louisville, you know,
right,
if you want one, or a thousand other places, right? I don't really, I'm not all that taken by the idea to begin with. And most of my students who ask me at length and seriously what I think they ought to do to pursue their writing in their interests as writers, I end up telling them to go join the Coast Guard or to go to Japan or to get out on the street, you know.
In other words, to experience life.
Yeah, to get out and do and to get under economic necessities, to study Greek, or you know, I mean, there's a certain kind of student that can get a whole lot at a very critical time in their lives out of association with mentors or teachers or other people trying to write, some not.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the only way.
Right.
And it is in the minds of most people at that juncture in their life, the only thing they can imagine. It's the only thing people are talking about. I don't think that's healthy. I know that's
right.
Not healthy.
Have you found that you've had a lot of talented writing students here,
yes,
here at UK?
Yeah. The one of the reasons that I wanted to come back to UK was I know the kids here. I know where they came from. I haven't ever lived in eastern Kentucky or western Kentucky. I've always been in central Kentucky. But I have known a lot of people who came from eastern Kentucky and western Kentucky. I grew up with a lot of them. I went to school with a lot of them. I've talked with them. Mm-hmm. The experience of almost all the people coming to UK is much more familiar to me than it was when I was teaching NYU or Stanford or MIT. And that's an appreciable leg up in this business. And I'm able to help people here in a way that I wouldn't be able to help them elsewhere, in ways that I wouldn't think about trying to help them elsewhere.
For example?
Well, I know how their tongues have been tied if they came from eastern Kentucky or western Kentucky. All right, I know how to untie their tongues maybe better. And I know the feelings of provincialism that they're dealing with. I know not only the form of it, but the substance of it, the language of it. I know in many cases what they're scared of. I can lead them to their fears a lot quicker.
How do
you know,
you
put their feet in their fire.
How do you do that?
Do what? You
know, untie their tongues, put their feet in the fire.
Well, by direct confrontation. You know, I have students, I do work a lot with exercises, and at some point in working through the permutations of a given exercise, I say, okay, now do the same thing over again and untie your tongue, all right? Find, write this paragraph in which you say something that you're not supposed to say, that has been put off limits to you by somebody important to you, like your mother or your father or your pastor, or your brother, or your sister, or your lover, or your spouse.
Subject matter, or style,
yeah,
or anything.
Right. Give me a paragraph now in which you render the experience in the way we were asking you to do, the way I was asking you to do this other time, but now put one more condition on it, okay? You're talking about something that's been ruled off limits. Mm-hmm. And you start, everybody knows what it means to have your tongue tied. Very few people want to face it very directly, okay? And very few people want, when you get right down to it, to suffer the pain that's involved in untying your tongue. But everybody who's serious about the work knows exactly what you're talking about when you start talking that way. And they either take the challenge or they don't. And if the time's not right, they don't, and I don't push it. But if they do, then you've got the thread that you follow. Okay, if your tongue's tied here, where else is it tied? What else are you not supposed to say? The way that language, one of the ways that language acquires the intensity of literature is by passing over that threshold from what you can say into what you can't say. When you pass language over, when language passes through that hoop, okay, it acquires great intensity, and it becomes necessary language. It becomes language that's charged with a job of work, the kind of work that literature does. And it's only through the experience of those things as such that you can get the thread that you need, okay, and find it. So you find it very difficult to talk about, I see now, the male authorities in your life. Okay, then let's follow it. Let's follow it. Let's trade. And you get really close then to what they're afraid of. And the minute you know what they're afraid of, you know, then you've got the basic rite de passage. That's what you've got to get through. That's what you've got to face. And does this make sense to you?
Yes. Yes. I'm wondering if you can talk about one or two specific students that have gone through that rite of passage and what's become of them since.
Well, I have in my experience at UK a number of quite gifted students, and a very intense connection with most of them. And yet I'm not, in my connection with them, trying to get them to be poets or writers. My connection with them, I think, is they have come with the ambition to write. And for me, that's the desire, whether they understand it or not, to make a connection with part of their mind that's been closed down all these years. That's my job, is to make that connection for them, help them make that connection, and to lead them into it. Some of my students have gone on to write and to publish and to prove themselves as writers, but that's not what our connection is about, and it's not the way I'm following them.
Because Leon Driscoll once said to me that he viewed his job as a creative writing teacher as freeing students to be themselves. That's pretty much what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is, and it's based on the assumption that none of us are very likely to know who we are. We're likely to know really well what other people want us to be, right? And know everything that's expected of us. But usually people who want to write are responding to the fact that there's something down there that won't quite come out in conversation, that can't come out in conversation. The language of conversation won't deal with it.
Right.
The language of an essay can't touch it or deal with it. There's something down in there that their communication in the rest of their lives has left alone, and they're suffering from it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They want some outlet. They want some expression.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like expressing their feelings. You can punch a punching bag and express your feelings, or you can go home and shout at your the person you're irritated with. There's
but
a whole,
you're wanting a truth as well.
And wanting to understand it, wanting to take that feeling to its source, wanting to understand it.
Right.
And some people who come into workshops that at UK don't really want that, or when they find out that that's what it's all about, they're gone. But a lot of them, that's where they're coming from, right?
Mm-hmm.
They've got something, they don't know what it is. They got something to say and they don't know what it is. So, yeah, if it's freeing them up to be themselves, but it's much more nearly freeing them up to discover themselves, all right?
Right.
To go where it takes to find out
right.
what that is
mm-hmm.
that has no words,
mm-hmm.
that has no voice, right? Writers are people who have experienced voicelessness. Inarticulateness about things of critical importance,
right.
having their tongues torn out, and trying to get them back. And that's a very, it's a very private, and it's a very delicate, and it's a very explosive connection and endeavor.
And you would agree that the truth is usually more complicated than a factual understanding of something,
well,
an event, or a situation.
Oh, of course. Yeah, a good deal more complex. The first thing I found out that my experience was a good deal more complex than it seemed to be, okay? And it took about 10 years to find that out, and then it took about 20 years to find out what that might mean, what the substance of that
mm-hmm.
idea was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next stage for me was to find out it's absolutely simple, that it's not complex at all, right? You go through, you peel the onion far enough down, you find out there's an onion to peel, and you
mm-hmm.
peel it down, and you end up with something utterly simple.
Mm-hmm.
Simpler than you ever thought it was to begin with, simpler than anybody ever told you it was.
Right. But there's a complexity to that simplicity, or else you would have, that would be all you had to say.
I think, yeah, what the experience is a deepening into your mind, then you find that there's a lot more going on the deeper you get. That's where the facts filter down into the feelings that generate them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the parts of your body and soul at war with one another and in a
mm-hmm.
struggle. And as you deepen down into your mind and the connection with the felt experience is distinguished from the facts of the matter, okay,
mm-hmm.
the felt experience, things get really wild and obscure and difficult and very hard to face, very problematical. Like if you face this, you're liable to untie
right.
the neat little picture you've made of your entire life to that point, okay?
Yeah,
I mean, I've got students all the time who can't write the poem or the story they're trying to write because it would involve a divorce or a fight with their father or something they just simply don't want to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But the complexity, what we're calling the complexity, is to me is like it's a deepening into the feeling and into the censorship that has gone on. There are a lot of facts that have been left out, and there are a lot of feelings that have been said you cannot indulge that. You cannot have that feeling about your mother.
But I'm saying that when you get to the core of the feeling, you're suggesting that it is more complex than just that, which is why most writers are not just who are professional or professional writers are people who write more than one poem or one book. This is why they have more than one thing in them.
Yeah, that's true, but it's also true, isn't it, that most of us have only one story to tell, and that the work of, say, the life's work of most writers is an effort to discover what it is writing the same story over and over and over again until they get it right or don't, right? I mean, Hemingway told the same story over and over and over again, and, you know, he finally got it at its purest form, it seems to me, at the end of his life with The Old Man and the Sea, but it was the one thing that he had to say, his story, and he went at it this way and that way and the other way, and I think probably that's true of most. There are a few geniuses, you know, like Faulkner or Tolstoy, Proust, who've got three stories to tell, okay, instead of one, all right? But it's not, I mean, it seems to me that in the case of most writers, their work is although it's variegated and might appear to be all over the place, is spiritually an effort to close in on the truth of their life.
Okay, so you're referring to one poetic vision or personal vision that they come at from various perspectives, but to clarify it for themselves as well as their readers.
As they possibly can, to understand it.
Right.
To embody it in language or in image.
Mm-hmm.
And to have the approximate language of conversation, the terribly approximate language of conversation, the approximate generalized language of the essay made clear and precise and concrete and absolute. I mean that the literature holds out the possibility of precise language and of things being clear. And one of the basic experiences of literature is to find that you need 7,000 words for the idea that we have with one word, clarity, all right? Like, you know, you got clarity, but then you got things that are a little bit clearer than that, right? That are really, really vivid. And then on the other side of that, if you get vivid enough and deep enough, they become luminous, and there's about 17 stages along the way. You know, it's like Eskimos and snow. They have a lot of words for it because it's really important to their lives. We only got two or three words for this absolutely essential proposition of clear thinking, of clarity of thought.
And because you have to show instead of tell experiences to make them real or true, it takes that much to do it.
And and by showing, you're dealing in particulars. You're dealing in precise particulars with imagery, images, not thoughts, not ideas. Those are roadmaps. All right, literature wants you in the territory.
Mm-hmm. Right. So back to your teaching at UK. You mentioned having known Wendell Berry for a long time. Was that from your undergraduate days?
Yeah, we were undergraduates together.
I see.
And had workshops, we were in writing workshops together, and then we were together at Stanford. He went to Stanford as a fiction writing fellow a couple of years before I did, 3 years before I did, and we were together out there and had a very intense 15-year exchange of manuscripts, young writers trying to find out what they're doing. We worked very, very closely for years and years. And I knew Gurney Norman as an undergraduate at UK, and Ed McClanahan, and Bobby Ann Mason. We were all at UK at the same time. Wendell was 1 year ahead of me. Gurney was a couple of years behind. Bobby Ann was a year behind Gurney. And Ed came in as a graduate student, but we were all there at the same time. And a good deal of the intensity that we were able to generate and sustain as young people with writerly ambitions had to do with the fact that there were several of us that had them, all right?
That's maybe what I was referring to earlier as the circle of...
Yeah. I wasn't in at that time thinking back that far, but indeed, at the inception of my ambitions as a writer, I had in my immediate surroundings several people, Wendell being the foremost, who were as interested as I was mm-hmm. in engaging this possibility and carrying it through.
It sounds from the way you're referring to these people that the relationships were cooperative and supportive,
yes.
but not competitive.
Yes.
Which they can often be
yes,
in creative situations.
Yeah, they sure can. I had, as all of those people did, an exceptional, I think, experience of the absence of competition for years and years. In fact, when I got to Stanford, the most unlikely workshop that the Stanford writing program has probably ever had, we had Larry McMurtry and Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Larry McMurtry wrote Leaving Cheyenne in the workshop that I've started, Yates Paul, and that Gurney started, The Stories and Kinfolks. And there were six other people in there writing publishable work, and there was no competition in that group. We were all interested in one another's well-being and supported one another's career. That's extraordinary.
Yes,
That won't happen very often.
No,
the higher the level of talent, the less likelihood that it's going to be free of competitiveness and selfishness.
And you have, many of you continue to mentor one another as you are colleagues with one another.
We did that for years and years. There comes a point in midlife as a writer where you don't need so much of that as you once did. I have a mentor relationship with my wife, Marianne Taylor Hall, and we read one another's manuscripts, and she now provides the kind of help that I need, and a couple of other people as well. But during the period in which you really need a lot of it, I had a lot of it, and it was really good. I mean, it was really good. Wendell is very good at that and was exceptionally forthcoming at that time. Gurney's good at it.
Mm-hmm.